Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. These programs are sponsored by listeners like you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on a journey through culinary history, as usual. Today, we're looking at the history and art of dim sum. When the Michelin-starred chef Andrew Wong was on a working tour of China, it ignited curiosity in not just exploring the vast cultural and regional differences that have come to define the gastronomic identity of China, but also opened his eyes to the beauty of China's 3,000-year history firsthand. It inspired newfound respect for the local and ceremonial aspects of Chinese culinary heritage and began the formation of ideas for his own approach to cooking. He sought help and collaboration with Dr. Mukta Das, food historian of China and Chinese diaspora, to find answers to his culinary history questions. Such is the case now with their recent research on the history of dim sum and its relationship to the pastry arts. Andrew Wong is an award-winning chef and anthropologist. He is British-born of Chinese heritage and with a combined academic background, this has led to a cooking style with one foot, I love this part, one foot firmly placed in the future and the other inspired by the past. Andrew opened his restaurant, A. Wong, in 2012 with his wife, Natalie. The A in the restaurant pays homage to his parents, Albert and Annie, because they had had a restaurant actually in the same place. Until Andrew opened his restaurant. Andrew's restaurant was awarded its first Michelin star in 2017, and in 2021, he was awarded a second Michelin star. He's also a research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies Center in London. And Mukta and Andrew are no strangers to podcasting because they have a podcast of their own. And we'll talk more about that later. So welcome both of you to the show. And I'm so happy to be chatting with you. I've enjoyed listening to you on your podcasts.
Oh, well, thank you, Linda. It's a real pleasure for us to be on your show. Thank you so much for the invitation.
No problem. And Andrew, well, basically, I guess first Mukta, I would ask you to describe a little bit how you became involved with food history, especially Chinese. I know you have said in one of your bios that Chinese cuisine is not and has never been monolithic. So this question goes out to both of you, really. But so Mukta, you first. Is that what got you interested in Chinese cuisine?
Absolutely, Linda. I mean, I've been a multiculturalist for as many years as I can remember, really. So prior to my academic career starting, I was, you know, I've had lots of different kinds of friends and lots of different kinds of eating experiences. And when I was young, I was born in London, in England, but I was raised.
Because I forgot to read your bio. But go ahead. Now you're giving it to me. Okay.
no problem. So I was raised a little bit in India in the western in the eastern parts of India, and we had a thriving Chinatown there, and I was raised in sort of Assam, which is the northeastern state, which buttresses up against southwest China. So it's really hard to kind of pin down a moment when I started to be involved or interested in Chinese food history, Chinese history in general. I did my academic career started a long time ago. I did a master's in Chinese and Indian history, but then only recently did I go back and complete a PhD in anthropology, and especially food anthropology, and focused on Chinese food history and Chinese food culture. So there's not one moment, but it's been a really long love affair, I think, with China and its food. So it's a difficult question to answer.
Indeed, I'm sure. And Andrew, you are also an anthropologist. You are a research assistant at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the center in London.
Well, first and foremost, I'm a chef. First and foremost,
of course you're a chef.
I would never ever be bold enough to say that I'm an academic, because that is strictly a very specific set of skills that Mukta possesses, and I definitely don't. But the research associate kind of came about through kind of collaborative work that we did together. And it became apparent that there was more to our collaborative relationship, more than just being kind of one way, in the sense of just asking Mukta for information and for archives or for old poetry, old anthropological studies. It became more than that. It became more of a kind of a conversation. And it became a conversation where I was able to push back with very, very kind of pragmatic points or chef points, which sometimes academics kind of let through the cracks, purely because they don't seem apparently obvious.
All right. It's clear to me, and I will give people your podcast title. It's called Exo-Soused. I love that name. And you attempt to do this, every couple of weeks, every month or so. And it's on, you can find it on Apple Podcasts. But it is evident from that the two of you really have this wonderful rapport, and there's a lot of give and take, and you feed off one another and throw each other, you know, questions and ideas and topics. And what I am interested in is how you decided and chose to apply some of that to your cooking, Andrew.
You know what? I think the main reason behind a lot of the inspiration came from the fact that, you know, when you learn the craft of being a chef, I think a lot of the time throughout your training, it's very much about kind of replicating other people's stuff. You're either replicating kind of classical recipes, or you're replicating dishes that you've seen, or you're replicating ideas that you've noted from somewhere, done by someone else. And I think it comes a point, and it came a point probably like 6 years, 7 years into opening a restaurant, that it was kind of like, we wanted to find a direction and a source of grounding for our cuisine that wasn't just about replicating other people's work. And so our conversations with Mukta and the ideas that we bounced around over coffee and over long discussions was very much about using that as the inspiration behind a new direction for the restaurant.
Are you often surprised at how similar some of these ancient recipes or dishes are to a lot of foods you have been cooking in your present day?
You know, absolutely. I think the overarching kind of understanding that I get from all our work is that, you know, we're not here to reinvent the wheel. It doesn't matter how much technology you can accumulate over 3,000 or 4,000 years. Actually, there are some very, very fundamental staples about food, about deliciousness, about the fact that they have cultural identities, the fact that they have medicinal qualities. These are all kind of universals that might slightly change and morph through time, but actually they're always apparent, and it's just the way that the lens that we look through, that changes, as opposed to the food in itself changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always surprised at how medicinal so many of the ancient texts are, as you just mentioned, and that that if you and then you read and you're surprised, you know, one is surprised to find out, oh, gee, and there's the origin of their use of peppers, which actually came late in there.
Sure, we look through a lot of ingredients. You know, I think one of the most surprising ingredients that Mukhtar ever highlighted to me was the use of rhubarb, for example. You know, I think coming from an upbringing in the UK, you kind of assume that rhubarb is probably British, or at least European by origin. But you know, when Mukhtar started sending me information on these medicinal recipes using rhubarb, dried rhubarb, and piecing together a case that actually there's probably more information to show that rhubarb's been around in Chinese cooking longer than it's been around in British cooking, you know, it really begins to set a starting point for an investigation or a further conversation. And a lot of our work isn't necessarily about replicating old recipes. You know, we look at thousands of recipes. And we did make a very important decision early on that we never wanted to just look at a recipe and recreate it and go, well, here it is. And we wanted to have a broader kind of approach to it, kind of almost a painter's approach to it, in the sense that we wanted to kind of capture moments in time, experiences in time, through particular foods and dishes, as opposed to just being, this is a recipe from this recipe book from this moment of time, and let's just recreate it. I think when you do that, and plus the recipes are very, very, what should I say, simple a lot of the time. The way they're written, they're very, very kind of four-word, five-word listed ingredients. They're not particularly elaborate at all. So actually, I think if we were to go down that route, I think if anything, it would end up being more counterproductive than productive.
Right. I mean, I found that in doing research on ancient recipes and even just very old recipes, they assume that the reader knows a lot about cooking, and you know, very rare are there amounts given, you know, or amounts, times, temperatures. It's basically an outline, a structure,
I mean, a lot of them were logs, right? So a lot of them were medicinal logs of the emperor, of, you know, for his physicians to know, you know, what he's had in his diet, and therefore what can be altered over time. And so, you know, the functional of collating this information never really was to be able to recreate, you know. If anything, chefs in the times that we're discussing, you know, were always very, very secretive of their know-how. And actually, you know, the idea of writing it all down for someone else to know probably wouldn't have been their preference.
Mukhtar, I'm turning to you, and that is, I would imagine, as far as looking at primary sources must be extremely difficult, because I'm not sure that you read all the different Chinese languages of the dialects, or, you know, that are written in. What do you fall to most frequently when you go to research some of these? Let me ask a question like the history of dim sum.
It's a difficult one, Linda. And yes, I do read Chinese scripts. So it's not the language isn't so much of a barrier, but it is, as you say, the primary sources are written with a specific audience in mind. And often these aren't chefs transmitting knowledge. You know, we don't have that kind of Escoffier kind of le guide cuisinier, you know, you don't have that kind of level of transmission of knowledge in these texts. So it is about the gaps. And sometimes these are really big gaps. And one of the really large conceptual gaps is, what is dim sum? Like, how do we even start to think about dim sum as a sort of historical piece? We kind of maybe are very hyper aware of dim sum's supposed origins in Guangzhou, in Hong Kong, during the kind of 1800s, that long 1800 period with European European treaty ports opening up China, and a kind of level of of East and West mingling, a kind of a different kind of cultural history coming out from that period in which dim sum grew and became a kind of if you like, a kind of export industry, with chefs coming out of China and entering into San Francisco and New York and London. So dim sum has its kind of trajectory from that period. But actually, what Andrew and I have discovered is that, you know, when we think of dim sum in a broader sense, as a kind of repertory of skills, as a kind of principle of eating snacks and beautiful dishes between meals and with tea and over different kinds of occasions outside of family meals, we start to find different kinds of recipes and inspirations for dim sum from very early on, from the Tang Dynasty onwards. And so you have instances of, even earlier than that. So if we take these principles and think about these things as, you know, beautiful things to be had in between meals, we can always look to the Confucian era texts and see certain delicacies coming out from that to be had, in small quantities, and you start to sort of see this kind of tradition of dim sum happening from a very early age and from various regions of China. It just in the 1800s, they just happened to kind of land in Guangzhou at this really important period of Chinese history and Chinese culinary history and become a kind of culinary super category in and of itself. But really, we can see the antecedents in lots of different places and regions and different times in history.
Mm. And Andrew, as far as you, do you incorporate dim sum in your restaurant at all? I mean, you're a very high-end restaurant. The dim sum is usually, you know, in these big banquet halls serving lots of people. However, I'm assuming it can be translated into a very delicate individual dish. Do you use the theory of dim sum itself in any of the dishes?
Yeah. I mean, Linda, absolutely. I think dim sum is probably the most important part of what we do in a restaurant. And the reasons for that are not purely because of the fact that I'm always in awe of dim sum chefs with the level of dexterity, the level of artisanal skill that is required in producing these things. But in a strange kind of way, the narrative of surrounding the exportation of dim sum from the southern Chinese regions in the 1850s, I think that's a story that quite resonates with me in particular, because we're a restaurant serving dim sum in the UK. And a lot of this stuff is linked to colonial eras. And a lot of the inventions that happened in dim sum in particular are a result of trade relationships and introduction of otherwise Western ingredients into the Chinese repertoire during this time. And that's why I feel it's super important for it to be rediscussed, I think, on the gastronomic scene anyway. I think over the past 100 or so years that Chinese restaurants have been around in North America, in Europe, and in the UK, I think there's been a very strong relationship that people have built with what they perceive to be dim sum and what they allow it to almost stand for. And what I hope to do in the restaurant anyway is to get people to reconsider that. If we really look back at the 1850s, we're talking about a time when dim sum wasn't just a pastime. It wasn't just a Saturday afternoon, a Sunday afternoon thing. You know, this really was about celebrating the most skilled chefs from around China, trying to serve the very best ingredients, the very best technical mouthfuls of skill to a very, very highbrow clientele. And the way that it's transpired, you know, for the next 200 years, you know, is obviously very individualistic depending on the country that it's gone to. But I think that it's lost its original meaning of what it was and what it stood for to start with.
We're going to talk a little bit more about what it really means and what it stood for when we come back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Andrew, you were talking about how you think a lot of the history of what dim sum really was and what it meant has been lost somehow in translation. But let's talk about that. Or Mukta, you chime in about what was the original meaning of dim sum, and what, you know, what, how, when was it served? How was it served?
I mean, unlike Andrew, and this is probably where we sometimes have a bit of a disagreement, I don't think of the 1850s as fundamentally the birth of dim sum, of the kind of at the kind of quality that Andrew's talking about. I think of it as a very long process. And I think from the very beginning, Guangdong, the southern province of China, has been sort of a center of excellence for Chinese culture. And I think dim sum comes from this striving, this drive to be a center of excellence of Chinese culture, because Guangdong has always been sort of at the forefront of international trade, not just with the Europeans from the 1800s, 1700s actually, on onwards, but, you know, from with East Africa, with Southeast Asia, with East Asia, you know, it's been a kind of a hotspot, a melting pot of all sorts of different influences over centuries. And so what you have here is artisans of a really high caliber taking all these foreign influences for 2 millennia and turning them into excellent crafts and art for Chinese consumption. And so what you have with dim sum is a reflection of this incredible technical and cultural skill that's been honed and honed and honed over several centuries. And so this kind of Lingnan, this kind of Guangdong culture is kind of, it is dim sum, in my opinion. It's like it's a reflection of this kind of this kind of strive towards this sort of marrying of foreign and Chinese influences and styles into something that is high class and recognizably Chinese, but incredibly different and elite and beautiful. So dim sum to me sort of represents this kind of this technical skill, this kind of, if you like, this kind of sweat economy <Yeah. laughs> of making it into something beautiful. And so,
I'm sorry. And you spoke about one of you mentioned delicate parcels, and that just stuck in my brain because that's all I can picture, you know, are these beautiful, if anyone has seen, you know, beautiful arrays of dim sum, just, I mean, the time and as Andrew, as you said, the technical ability and artisanship, just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like that's really the conversation is the fact that somehow, for something that started in my school of thought anyway, something that I'm saying that started under these conditions or for being something that was meant to celebrate the very, very best of what China had to offer in the mid-1800s. You know, somehow it traveled the world, and somehow in 2022, it's almost become just a habit as opposed to a celebration. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think that, you know, it's had incredible implications for the way that Chinese communities have spread and how they have integrated into other cultures. But at the same time, I think that speaking from the perspective of 2022, when now the world is so open and there is so much information available to everyone, I do feel that in a strange kind of way, I think that in revisiting the origins of what dim sum originally was, I think that there definitely should be another look at what it is and what it could be and what the potential for it is, gastronomically speaking.
And so many over the years, I mean, since, I mean, American chefs or other nationality chefs are using this gastronomic art and art form, I guess I don't know what you call it together, you know, the gastronomic arts, to create interesting new dishes, creating this dim sum type of dish. But my question is, too, to just in Mukta, you had touched on this, that I think of, you know, the trade routes and tea houses and, of course, having a little something to, you know, a little bite to eat and travel along your way, which so many people talk about as origins of dim sum. But do you have any idea when the name was applied to it, dim sum, which actually has a specific meaning, right?
I don't actually know when it would have been common usage. I mean, I'm assuming to some extent, I mean, in Guangdong in the 1850s, when it became a much more of a, you know, a citywide phenomenon, these tea houses and these tea restaurants and these fabulous places, you know, they probably would have been born out of that time, where we would have differentiated between these kinds of all day ability to snack and to enjoy not only the teas with the dim sum, but also the entertainments, the singing arts, the plays, the dramas that would have also been available to tea house patrons at that time, as opposed to sort of banqueting and restaurant meals, where you would have had a very different kind of format. And perhaps your listeners would, you know, who, you know, frequent Chinese restaurants understand, you know, where you have, you know, large servings of family style meals. These are very different from sort of sitting down to have dim sum on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon. You know, very different formats, very different kinds of ideas of how you balance a meal. So I think at that point there would have been a separation, but I'm not entirely sure when the phrase or the name dim sum would have been, or dian xin would have been applied to this actual form of eating. Andrew, do you know?
Well, but I also feel like the other important point to make here is that, you know, this, no one really has a very concrete definition of what dim sum actually is, right? I mean, Mukta and I discuss this at length all the time, is that, you know, you look across the world and actually you're talking about 50 or 60 items that have near enough traveled the whole globe, and that's become almost the accepted repertoire. But actually, as we look back, and if we look further back pre-1850, what we're actually seeing more so is that actually the foods that were coming under the umbrella of dim sum, there was a lot more than what we perceive to be the repertoire currently. So I think that, you know, it was a much wider selection. We've kind of found sources of kind of maybe 2,000-3,000 items which came under this umbrella of dim sum, but we don't hear about them now. You don't really see them very often now. And a lot of the time you may or may not even categorize them as being dim sum in the way that we like to pigeonhole things anyway. You know, a lot of them may be soups, braised meats, small steamed meat items. They weren't all dumplings. They weren't all necessarily under this apparent category, which we kind of turned fact in our contemporary times.
Yeah. Well, I have had the privilege of seeing a lot of photographs from your restaurant, and anyone can, if you go to the website, a.wong.com, the name of the restaurant. Andrew, you have, I mean, you talk about the artistry, the technical ability, and you are employing this in, from what I've noticed, in many of your dishes. I mean, I saw these incredible packets, and I have to say that they were looked like a something that, not anything that I've ever been served dim sum, but in the steamer basket, these incredibly beautiful little mini crepes that I don't know what is inside. Looked like maybe there was some uni sticking out, but there was caviar on top, and there was a truffle slice, and beautiful colored pastry ribbon running around it. This had to be a labor of love that you developed when you were like a painting. I mean, or as you say, the relationship to the pastry arts. And so, what is your take on that?
You know, the take on it is one where I just want to address the similarities and skills that exist. You know, I grew up in a time when, you know, in the 80s, when, again, dim sum was very new to London at that time. You know, there were probably only two or three restaurants in the 80s that were serving dim sum. It was very novel at the time. But it became novel for something that was just purely Chinese. Yet, obviously, what we know now and is that actually it's not, is it? Dim sum is an amalgamation of not only Chinese ingredients, Chinese skills and Chinese cuisine, but also it has many influences from the West, the introduction of butter, the introduction of certain textures that you see in dim sum. Those are not probably, again, this is argumentative, but probably not originally from China. They're probably things that be brought to China and then become part of our gastronomy. You know, I mean, recently speaking, I was looking at a sponge cake called a malai go, which is, you know, Malay cake in translation. You know, and then there's many, many stories about how it came to be, whether or not you're talking about from the Malay Peninsula into China, or you're talking about from China back to Malaysia. But the one thing that is probably openly accepted is that there was some influence from the British colonial rule. And secondly, this idea of British colonials finding almost a semblance between dim sum and afternoon tea. And I think, you know, that in a celebration within itself, I think is so nice. It's finding similarities between cultures who are seemingly so different at the time, through food and through eating. And I think if you can hold on to these kind of larger ideas of what food is and larger ideas of what dim sum is, I think it gives you a lot more joyful interpretation.
Mukta, I heard both of you talking about not this, but the Song Dynasty, which just goes way back to medieval times, and how there was so much care taken in a lot of the preparation. And I'm thinking of dim sum, and I love the analogy of dim sum to British tea. I mean, the tea ceremony, the serving of these little bites, but they're, you know, they always say, you know, we eat with your eyes, right, first before you taste anything. And this certainly, was this evident in any of these early ancient texts, or that eating, you know, making food beautiful, so that certainly we know in ancient Roman times, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Linda. In fact, I mean, there are not that many surviving texts from ancient times towards now in Chinese food history. So what we can glean, we glean from, you know, a handful, about 20, and I usually consult about 8 when I'm working with Andrew. And one of the key texts that I usually look at when I think about aesthetics and what's on the plate and if that delights the senses or not is a text from sort of the 400s, 400 AD to 500. We're not entirely sure when it was written. Essential Arts for the People's Welfare, Qi Min Yao Shu. And what's incredible there, from very early on then, you have this kind of care taken over how the plate looks and how to finish things. And so even from that, from very early on, when most writers of food texts in China at this point were kind of very concerned with making sure that there was enough food to, you know, people were farming well, they were cooking, you know, seasonally, people had enough to eat. Actually, this text stood out because it is really about how to delight the senses. And so you have this kind of, this tracks then all the way through to the Song Dynasty, where you have these much more elaborate texts. And the big difference between 400 AD and 900 or 1200 AD is that you have incredible amounts of trade going on. So you have all these incredible ingredients, lots of different kinds of spices and luxury foods coming into China through Guangdong. So you have this vast array of material available to you that you can start to play around with, match colors, look at different kinds of preparations. You have wok frying, you have seed oils, you can flash fry things, you can twice cook things. All sorts of things suddenly become really possible in the Song Dynasty. Lots of different kinds of technology in the kitchen, on the farm, means that there are all sorts of different kinds of food and vegetables at such great abundance that you can start to kind of play around and look for delightful things. So even though you have this kind of this obsession, I guess, with creating beautiful food from 400 AD onwards, actually in the Song Dynasty, you get this kind of peak of culinary culture where it's possible to kind of really, really turn this kind of elite pleasure into restaurant food for the middle classes, for the merchant classes, and for a broader sweep of Chinese eaters. And so, I think that's where it kind of deepens and seeds into Chinese culinary culture.
Hmm. Andrew, where do you see your work with this further exploration of dim sum going?
First of all, back to your previous point about plating and making things beautiful. I think, you know, that in itself as a definition has changed over time. You know, if you took it kind of, even if you look at European cuisine, if you compare kind of what was perceived to be beautiful in Escoffier's time and you compare it to now, you know, in a time where there's especially in high-end cuisine, like there's this look to kind of Scandinavia, simplicity, organicness, you know, the way that Japanese cuisine has been elevated, well, not even been elevated, been kind of revered as being high cuisine as well. If anything, I feel like the work that Mukhtar Navai looked through is that the beauty comes from the simplicity, you know, so that's very much a kind of route that I like to think and like to think along when we try to find presentations for our dishes, is that, you know, we're not trying to make them all singing, all dancing with lots of different colors and lots of different fireworks all over them. There's something about the simplicity in letting the ingredient be the beauty, number one. And number two, again, with a lot of this banqueting that we've looked into, it's about the collection of these seemingly simple things collectively becoming something beautiful. And I think the beauty comes from that. You know, it comes from the fact that, you know, okay, if it's a very, very lightly piece of pickled carrot all by itself in a bowl, okay, it may not seem the most beautiful thing in the world. But once you set it out as an array of 8 or 9 different pickles, I think then you begin to paint a very different picture of what that table looks like and how you may perceive beauty. And in my opinion, I really feel that really is, in my opinion, very, very high-end cuisine. Which for me personally as a chef is as beautiful as it comes. And if anything, if we talk about the work that we like to do moving forward, is very much I'm trying to celebrate along those lines, in trying to, you know, use the past with an understanding of our current times and the future, and trying to find, you know, delicious mouthfuls which will you know, be representative of us in a specific time, representing a specific cuisine.
Well, from what I can see, you are well on your way to, you have been for many years. But it's something that I look forward to see further in your work. And you can hear a lot of this back and forth. As you can see, sometimes they don't always disagree, these two, but I mean, they don't always agree. But I encourage you to listen into some of their podcasts. Again, it's XO Soust. You got it. Soust. It's Soust with XO. And they just have these wonderful rambling conversations that, not rambling so much, they are focused, but they, you know, they let their opinions come out, but they are always informed and very entertaining. So, and I thank you both for joining me today to try to shed some light on the history of dim sum. I see it's very, very foggy or, you know, not quite so clear, but dim sum, I believe it, one of the translations was touch the heart, and that certainly sounds like that's something you've been doing. Andrew, I can't wait to visit your restaurant and try some of your wonderful food. And Mukta, I look forward to hearing more from you. What more can I say? When is the book coming out? That's it. Andrew, you have a book, I know, of A. Wong. It's a book from the restaurant, a cookbook, right? Or
it was a cookbook written a very long time ago. Yeah,
2015. Have, that's a long time ago, yes, yeah. Right?
I think, you know, times have changed, and I think our cuisine has changed. And so we look forward to writing a new one.
Well, I can hear the wheels turning already in this, and it's just wonderful work that you do, and I really look forward to hearing more from you and hopefully talking to you more too.
Please do. We look forward to it too, Linda.
Right. So, and again, you can find more at XO Soust from these two, and that is Dr. Mukta Das and Chef Andrew Wong. Terrific conversation, people. Enjoyed it very much. And
thank you, Linda.
And for my listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's program, and I thank you for listening. And you can find more of our podcasts on heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you visit Heritage Radio, don't forget to click the heart in the upper right corner and consider a donation. Keeps us going. Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.